think back to a day when music wasn't so, let's say, labeled, use the word labeled. 50s, 60s, there was country music, there was folk music. Now we apply these labels, bluegrass, acoustic music. They all kind of blended together, and they've never really separated. And you can find different performers in different types of music that fit in there. Some you might call folk, but really the songs and the music is so related and so connected. And I can't think of a better proponent today, in this day and time, than Mike and Ruthie. Mike Marinda and Ruthie Unger Marinda. They also perform with the Mammals. They are folk music. They are folk music, which includes all of that acoustic, old time, some bluegrass. And I'm so happy to have met them finally and had a chance to talk with them. We're going to hear the first part of a two-part show with Mike and Ruthie as we talk about their music, their influences, some wonderful music. At the end of our first part, you're going to hear a song which may be the best folk song, we'll call it, that I've heard in decades. And then in the second hour, we'll talk to Mike and Ruthie about that great old music that still exists and still continues today. I'm really happy to finally get a chance on Unreal Bluegrass to talk to Mike and Ruthie. We have a lot of things to talk about. We're going to take as much time as you feel comfortable. I know you guys are so busy here. We're sitting outside of the tent at Gray Fox. The sun is up, so maybe we'll avoid some of the good mud earth as we proceed through the day. You guys have been so busy. I met you last year, and I will say this. In my opinion, Mike and Ruthie are the you're the epitome of the current living legacy of American folk music. And I don't mean to say anything other than that. This is folk. When I see you guys play and I hear your music, this is folk music. And beyond that, it doesn't need further definition. Now, tell me a little bit about Mike and Ruthie. I want to talk about the Mammals who you're here with today, and anybody can start. I'm pretty open on these things.
I was just thinking, I never heard a horse play a song, right? Isn't that the quote?
Oh.
And then I started segueing into the Mammals a little bit right there.
Okay.
I guess.
Well, speaking of Mammals,
you know,
do you have any horses in your
house? I was feeling a little hoarse this morning after a nice dusty weekend. No, we have. We have been playing folk music for a long time, and you know, in the very early days of the Mammals, around 2001-ish, you know, the way to describe what we were doing in the early 2000s to people who don't know the difference between old time and bluegrass and folk and Americana and whatever,
yeah.
We would reference, people would reference, "Oh brother, where art thou?" Like, it's like that.
Yeah.
Or people would reference Nickel Creek, which was a band that really paved the way of mainstream people listening to, you know, fiddle, mandolin.
Yeah, sure,
you know.
Sure.
So I remember that was sort of how you'd explain it to people. I mean, I remember playing a gig once. We were basically playing folk rock. And afterwards, because I had been playing a fiddle, I guess, someone came up and said, "Oh, I love Irish music." You know, so.
And you said, "So do I."
I said, "Thank you." Because, you know, she was trying to pay me a compliment.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, it is, when you grow up like I did with a fiddle player dad, my dad's name's Jay Unger.
Sure.
A lot of people know his tune is Shokin' Farewell around the world. And, you know, I grew up with listening to all different fiddle styles because I grew up going to the Shokin' Music and Dance camps. And hearing Cajun and Celtic styles and old-time styles and everything and perceiving all those differences from an early age. And then you sort of realize, well, to most people, these all sound the same until you get a deeper knowledge.
Yeah.
People like me.
And when I met Mike, it was 1998, I think, and 99 was the first year I brought Mike and our friend Carter. We had a little trio at the time called Rheingold. Carter played the mandolin and guitar. Mike played guitar, I played the ukulele, and a little bit of fiddle. And then I thought, well, Mike, when I met him, was a rock drummer and songwriter who played guitar. And he kind of played in this style he had picked up from watching Ani DiFranco, which looked a lot like frailing a banjo to me. And I just had this idea with his rhythmic sense that he'd be a good banjo player.
You converted him.
I stuck a banjo in his hands, and by lunchtime on the first day...
For the record, Mike is just nodding.
By lunchtime on the first day of Ashokan Southern Week, he was wearing the banjo at the salad bar, you know, didn't want to take it off long enough to eat, and could play Pig in a Pen. And That was, yeah.
And
kinda,
the rest, as they say.
You know what? Pig in the Pen was one of the first tunes I learned, and I heard Ricky Skaggs play it at a blistering tempo in his concert set yesterday. It blew my mind. I didn't know Pig in the Pen was part of a performance repertoire for anybody. I thought it was just a nice, slow back porch beginning banjo.
It'd be like somebody getting up there and doing Three Blind Mice.
Exactly. It sort of came full circle for me yesterday with that Ricky Skaggs set.
Jimmy Mills, his former banjo player, since you mentioned the speed of that, when Jimmy was going to start playing with Ricky, told me this. Jimmy says, you know, Pig in the Pen? Yeah, and he goes, a little faster. And Mills plays 100 million miles an hour if you want him to. A little faster. So that breakneck speed, wherever Ricky came from, different place when you were hearing it in your mind. Yeah. I did not know you were from this world she just described. Tell me a little bit, because that's interesting.
Well, which world would that? Which one do you
the
mean?
Rock drummer, the rock drummer, songwriter,
right? So
Franklin,
the closest I got to folk music. I had great mentors growing up in music. My middle school music teacher turned me on to jazz and musical theater, and he really lit a fire under me to be a songwriter. He bought me my first 4-track. But I was really listening
to...
That's
very nice of a teacher.
Oh, he was a gem, and still is. His name's Dave Irvin. I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire. And he's still doing... In fact, his project right now with middle school kids is he has a... I think it's grown to be 90-piece orchestra that does performance for silent films, and they tore it. I think they just went to China. 90 middle school kids performing music for... And this is the type of ambitious project he undertakes.
Wow.
And he just pulls incredible... he defies all expectations for what young people can do with music. And people like me, it set me on my life course, you know?
Isn't that great?
And I just fell head over heels in love with songwriting. I started as a drummer, like Ruthie said. My first paid gig was a barn theater in Maine that Dave Irvin hooked me up with. He was in the pit orchestra, too, as a trombonist. And he said, I got this kid who can play drums. And mostly what you have to do to play drums for musical theater is a whole lot of... Oh, Oklahoma. I did that.
I was in that play too, probably around that same time, but we hadn't met yet.
And yet you didn't cross paths yet.
Well, it's sort of funny that I started in the musical theater world as a musician. I was making, I think, $150 a week. And mind you, I was only 13 years old.
Pretty good.
Not bad money for a 13-year-old summer job. But
it's not Portraits by Willie with a Y.
That's our son Steve is referencing. Yeah, our son figured out this money-making scheme at these festivals to do dollar portraits. And I think on the first day, he even got so bold to jump up on stage with us and get a little plug-in for his own
beautiful
portraits. He made about $37 that day. But anyway, I learned quickly that I was making more money than the actors. Right, these were adults. These were, a small town, and this was Maine, actually, the Hackmatack Theater, Barn Theater in Maine. But and that may not be true, but at the time I thought, wow, being a musician is just that much better than being an actor. Of course, Ruthie and I...
Story of our lives.
We're both...
this much better.
We were theater students through college and whatnot. We both studied theater in different places, but we both were in the theater world. But we both sort of settled on music as a career because it's... just that much more realistic to make ends meet, I guess. We have friends who have stuck with the theater, and it's a grind to be an artist in this culture, no matter what you pick.
That's true. You have to want to do it above all else.
Yeah. That's right, and we're so blessed that we do. We have two kids, and we travel around. We play concerts. We have a 5-piece band. We play as a duo. We give lessons. We run a festival. We have our bunch of irons in the fire.
Don't let me forget the festival name, because I
the
know.
Hoot.
The Hoot.
Yeah. We do the summer hoot in the winter.
Website is hoot.love, believe it or not.
I like it.
L-O-V-E. It's a new ending for the website. And while we're talking about the theater, I majored in theater too, and I ended up meeting Mike because we had friends in common in that theater world. And I, growing up with folk musician parents, I kind of saw what that life was like and thought, oh, I'm not going to do that. I had no interest in being a musician when I grew up. I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to do this whole totally different thing, right? So I enjoyed the theater, and I still think I used my theater training, both in just being on the stage, from breathing to stage presence to telling a story or whatnot. But there was a moment where it clicked, and it was really when Mike and I started playing together. In New York City, and I thought, well, when actors get together and hang out, they don't jam in the way musicians do. You know, it's not like, hey, I love that monologue you did last weekend. Let's hear that one again. Or here, you want to do this scene I've been working on?
Yeah,
you know, like here.
I never thought about that. I'll be Jane, and then you go ahead and do the other thing.
Exactly. I mean, I would.
We'll just riff back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, music is a bit more of a social experience, you know, off stage. And then also, like he said, you know, it's like you got to pay the drummer $150 a week, but some of the actors are actually paying you to be there. It's a ridiculous, ridiculous business proposition to be an actor. So we just thought, you know, maybe we'll, you know, start this band up. And we end up meeting Tal Rodriguez Seeger, who's, of course, the grandson of Pete Seeger. And between, you know, his knowledge of the scene and my knowledge of the scene, we, you know, booked a pretty decent string of shows. Our very first year in 2001, and the Mammals were born. As we say, our first record was called Born Live. And then we kind of went from there with the puns on the album. There was Evolver. And then Rock That Babe, I guess, isn't much of a mammal pun, but that's a fiddle tune. And that's what we did. We sang political songs. We played fiddle tunes. We sang any song. Anything that came into our head could be in a song. It was a mix between the personal expression of songwriting, which is where Mike had really found his passion, and then tunes and, you know, foot stomping music that we called all-timey, you know. So
all,
no one
you said all-timey.
All.
All-timey. All right.
Yeah, it could be alt-timey
could be
these
now,
days.
It could
yeah,
be all-timey.
But I kind of like all-timey because it's so inclusive and it's kind of shuts down the
one more genre splinter to add into the mix. Alt-timey
shuts down the folk Nazis when you say all-timey because you're not really claiming anything too specific. And anyway, we had a great time, you know, kind of building that up. And there were all these bands at the time like Uncle Earl and Foghorn String Band and the Ducks and who am I leaving out?
I spaced out for a second. Foghorn, the Ducks, Uncle Earl, Red Stick Ramblers were
the
scene, stepping in it from Michigan.
Crooked Still.
The Stairwell Sisters, Crooked Still. You know, it goes on and on. There was quite a posse of us bumping into each other on the circuit back in, I guess, when we were in our 20s. Right? This was like the, what do you call that decade?
The aughts.
They call it the aughts, is that right?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's a weird one.
And it was
the new millennium string bands.
Yeah, we didn't really think too much of it, but looking back, you know, it was great. It was a community, not geographically, but, you know, mentally.
Yeah.
That, and we'd run into each other at festivals and stuff. And
Ting Wilkie was part of that.
Yeah, and it was just a, I don't know, it was a really cool time. People were making records that were inspiring each other, and you can kind of hear that when you listen and circulate. You know, Aoife from Crooked Still is a close friend of ours. She sang on all the Mammals records a little bit, you know, here and there. I got to sing on most of the Crooked Still records, and
of course, Ruthie.
I remember listening to Uncle Earl's record before it was mastered, like sitting in their van at a festival in Florida, just like crammed in the van to listen to the record before it came out, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There were a lot of us sitting in parking lots playing each other the, like, mixes and kind of being like, check this out, this is where we're going right now. And it was cool because there's
that's
a supportive...
That's a community.
Yeah,
exactly.
And there's a supportive audience at the time, you know, and still is these festivals, you know, where you get to really see a visual of that community and kind of compare notes on what's going on. And, you know, it's a real business, you know, at this point. It's a real, it's a competitive thing, you know, but when you've got sort of partners in crime in that way and you kind of feel like you're all lifting the same boat of,
You don't have to fall all the way to the ground. You have someone who will support you.
Yeah.
You know, either enthusiastically or maybe help you find another gig. That's what I think.
And maybe to just fast forward real quick to now, you know, Mike and I, after the Mammals played for about 7-8 years, we did a lot of great stuff that, you know, has so many awesome memories of that incarnation of the band, which was a trio at the core and then became a 5-piece band with bass and drums and fiddle, banjo, guitar. So that was kind of our thing, the rock and roll string band all the time. And then when that kind of ran its course a bit, and when I was pregnant with our first kid, Willie, who's now 9, you know, we were a little burnt out on everything. And we were like, well, this seems as good a time as any to shift gears a bit. And Tal went his own way and did his own thing for a while, and we did too, and we became Mike and Ruthie. And the perception was, because it was like at the same time as having a kid, there was this perception that, like, oh, they're just sort of, you know, Mike and Ruthie, they're just kind of like playing a house concert here and there. But we really were still playing like a 90-100 shows a year for like another decade.
More like 200, actually.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, depending on the year. And you know, we started a festival 5 years ago and all the stuff that we did. But somehow the Mike and Ruthie name had challenges in that people perceived it as just sort of smaller time, no matter what we did. And people, presenters, would introduce us on stage as Mark and Ruthie or Mike and Judy. I'm not kidding. It happened so many times.
Even people we knew well.
Yeah, it's just like
I
hard.
I like Mark and Judy. I don't know.
Yeah, Mark and Judy.
That's just like,
yeah,
maybe
we should just run with that.
Those could have been our stage name.
It's kind of like, you know how John Hartford.
Better than Punch and Judy, I guess.
Name is actually John Hartford. Did you know that?
Only because you told me now, and I may have heard it, but yeah. I wouldn't have.
And his son went by Harford because he just kept the real family name. But, yeah, like, John Hartford, he just was like, whatever. People mispronounce
it
anyway.
Our last name is Miranda, which inevitably entropy takes it to Miranda. Well, that's not my name, but that's why we don't use it.
We should have just become the Miranda Wright. But either way, it was fun, you know, actually getting to do a smaller thing because it's less to organize. You know, it was just us, our kids, a minivan. And we did play a lot of house concerts. And we did do a lot of, like, you know, smaller festivals and a little bit of a simpler thing. But we, you know, maybe it was when Opal got old enough that, like, that's our second kid and she's five. And,
sure,
you know, maybe like 3 years ago we kind of thought, okay, she's out of the, like, riding on my back on the stage phase. We can have a loud drummer again. You know, she's not, like, right next to the cymbals anymore. She's, like, you know, hanging out and running around. We can build this band up. So first it was just the Mike and Ruthie band. And then we decided to become the Mammals again. And it's not 100% coincidental that the first incarnation of the Mammals was the George W. Bush presidency, and that under this new regime, we decided it was time to bring back the Mammals. It's not really...
It's poetic.
It's yeah.
Desperate poetry.
There's some desperate poetry being written. We have a poster that imitates the bat signal.
Yeah, I saw that.
With, like, the fiddle and banjo,
yes,
up in the sky,
yes,
because I feel like
I
don't know if everybody's screaming out for us to come out, but I'm screaming out for the Mammals again. I'm like, we're ready. You know, we're ready for mixing it up. It's not a set full of political rants, but one or two songs per set that really speak about what is going on or what could be going on. So it's pretty necessary right now. We can't just sing love songs beginning to end anymore.
Songs about a chicken.
Yeah.
I mean, you need both.
You need both. Mike's got a new song about a chicken.
It's called The Chicken Song.
Why sing about a chicken when you could be singing about peace?
Long time. Why sing about a chicken when you could be singing about peace? Sing about a chicken, could be singing about peace. Soon all my fears will be released. Long time. A long time, a long time, yeah.
No. You know, folk music, you guys can help because of your history, but folk music was not always just, you know, folky in the protest sense in the 60s. There was always a lot of other just great old songs, but they did, every once in a while, there would be a song that had a statement to make, whether it was directly in your face protest, but there were statements. That's leading up to where I'm going to go, you know, in a minute, but...
Well, you know, my dad wrote that tune, Show Some Farewell, and people cry when they hear it, and it means something to them. And it might not be a political thing, but it means something that tugs at their heartstrings. It doesn't matter if they, you know, if we have a common language. It's like one of those things that just makes you cry. My mom would sing country songs, weren't necessarily political, but she made people cry all the time at her shows, and I feel like that's what's in my blood.
Yeah.
It's like more than anything, it's just that communication of an emotion.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, once in a while my mom would like, she wrote this song, The Ballad of Francine Hughes. It was the tune of Pretty Polly, and she played on the banjo. My name is Francine Hughes, and I'll tell you no lie. Come listen to my story, and I'll try to keep from crying. I murdered my husband. There ain't no denying. And it's a true story. It was in the news, like in the late 80s.
Oh.
And she picked up this story of the burning bed. I don't know if you remember. It was made into a TV movie.
Yes, I do remember.
And she just, like, heard, I'm getting chills thinking about it. She heard the song. I mean, she heard the story and just sat there, and, like, the words flowed, and she wrote the whole thing. And it's a definite protest song. You know, it's like a battered wife tale.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful song, but with all that feeling of that old ballad. And it really, you know, that's a kind of an example of, you wouldn't want a whole set of those.
No,
oh, geez,
no, no,
you
no,
couldn't
no.
sit through it.
No.
But if it's framed properly, it can mean a lot to someone.
And that leads me to this. I told you as soon as I saw you the other day when you guys came in, I think water is the the most perfect. You described it much better than me because your statement was, I wanted to write a song that you couldn't really argue against.
Yeah, you're talking about My Baby Drinks Water.
I call it water. Yeah, My Baby Drinks Water.
Yeah, well, we write water on the set list. Yeah. You know? That's a good shortening.
Yeah, okay.
My baby drinks water. My baby drinks tea. My baby eats an apple from the old apple tree. My baby drinks milk Mother Nature gave me, so please spare the water for my little ones and me. And that's, you know, that's just something I wrote nursing our baby in Colorado when it was dry as heck and I needed to stay hydrated and was thinking about all the water shortages that are coming to this, you know, planet, this human race, and all the babies and all the pollutants and all the, you know, I read about some tests they do on breast milk. You think of that as, okay, this is perfect for my child, but you know what? There's toxins in there. It's in everyone. It's in everything. And we're not separate from what we throw in the trash or what we pour out onto the ground. It comes right back.
If your object was to make the statement that no one could disagree with in song, I still think that My Baby Drinks Water was, as soon as it was available for the, I put it in the show right away.
Thank you.
I saw it on Facebook. It's a water download or whatever. Yeah. I immediately got it in the playlist.
Mike recorded it in our house with my mom singing harmony with me. She sings a beautiful low part. And my dad and Molly came in, so in a bed of string droning. Mm-hmm. And we actually, like, inserted a space in the middle for my dad to play a haunting fiddle solo. And you know what we did? We cut it out.
I was going to say, I didn't hear these things.
You won't hear it.
Yeah.
You know why? It didn't need it.
Yeah.
And that was a weird lesson of, like, wow, if you don't need the haunting Jay Unger fiddle solo, it must be a pretty good song. Well, even he agreed. You know, it was one of those moments where you space out, and it's beautiful, and you start thinking, wow, it sounds a little like cinematic movie soundtrack music, and it's cool.
Yeah.
But then you come in with the last verse, and you go, oh, wait, yeah, what was she talking about?
Yeah.
Morning, Hazel. There's one of our amazing babysitters.
Didn't you enjoy My Baby Drinks Water as we came out of that first part of our visit with Mike and Ruthie? That's the tune I wanted to end it on. Second part of that will be next week, by the way. Equally fascinating.